Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. My name is Liana Chen. I teach Chinese and Taiwanese literature and Chinese language in the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures. First of all, I would like to welcome everyone to this event. This event is co-organized and co-hosted by three different units. The first one, we have to thank Seeger Center for their support. And this event is also co-sponsored by the Taiwan Academy of TechPro. And lastly, the Department of East Asian Languages and Literature. This is part of our East Asian Humanities Lecture Series. So today we are very fortunate to have Professor Jonathan Stalling here. Jonathan Stalling is professor of English specializing in East-West Poetics at the University of Oklahoma, where he's a founding editor of Chinese Literature Today magazine and book series, and the curator of the Chinese Literature Translation Archive at the University of Oklahoma Library. He's also the deputy director of the Center for the Study of China's Literature Abroad at Beijing Normal University. He was also the 2015 poet in residence at Beijing University. Dr. Stalling is the author of six books of literary scholarship, translation, and poetry, and his opera, Yinge Li Shi, was staged at Yunnan University in 2010. He has given two TED Talks. Before I move on to introduce his talk, I would like to have Dr. Benjamin Hopkins to come up here to give us some opening remarks.
Thank you, Liana. I would just echo what Liana's already said, that it's a great privilege and honor to welcome Jonathan to speak to us today. On behalf of the Seeger Center, which I'm the director of, it's a great privilege to also get out of the political science-y stuff that maybe we focus on so much and also see the relationship of culture to that. So I'm not the main event, Jonathan is, so let's get to him.
All right. Thank you so much. So in today's talk, Professor Jonathan Stalling will talk about the literary archive as it relates to Sinophone literature, with special attention paid to Taiwanese literature in translation. He will talk about archival efforts taking place in Taiwan and the establishment of the Chinese Literature Translation Archive at the University of Oklahoma, and relate these efforts to the broader effort to circulate Sinophone literature outside the Sinosphere. So let's welcome Professor Stalling.
Much for the invitation to come talk about something that I think you'll see quite quickly I'm very passionate about, which is documentation and archiving, something which essentially no civilization has done before, which is valuing the translator as a cultural producer. And their ephemera, their draft material, and so on is something we should be preserving. And that really, I say this in this way because actually the spaces that this is taking place are right here. It's in students' work. The students who are doing their first translations need to maintain a record of that work. And as we move into the digital age, self-curating becomes more and more difficult. And I'll talk a little bit about how and why I think this is so important, that if we are to understand the mechanisms of world literature, we need to understand the environmental, the intellectual environments in which world literature takes place. And of course, translation is how world literature takes place. And we actually know very little about it, because we've not studied it before. We have no evidence to draw upon. So that's where we will be going to. However, I wanted to spend some time Taiwan, Taiwanese in the title here, kind of talk a little bit about the different sorts of efforts happening in Taiwan today in regards to documenting Taiwanese literature as a space, and it's the Taiwan, and then talk a little bit about some Taiwanese literature that I'm involved in working on in the archive. So it's a bit like a tour for the first half of the talk, and then we'll get into some theory and so on toward the end. All right. So I wanted to start with with something that's true all over the world, which is the small bookstores are going under. They're replaced by big boxes, then later displaced by Amazon and other digital marketplaces. So to find, you know, a way to make book spaces viable in the new economy, found that Taiwan's ecosystem was really rich with novel solutions to that problem. This is one such place. Forgive me, I don't have access to my notes in this format. All that means is I don't have the names of everyone that, you know, otherwise it, so I will not be naming people by name. But this is one of the owners of this bookstore, and the, as you can see, the form of the store is all about mystery literature, and it's mostly in Chinese, Sinophone, but also other languages are there. And the entire store makes you want to go in. It's an immersive experience in the mystery kitsch of the genre. And so when you're there, you can also, of course, sit down with your coffee and tea and talk to people and kind of be immersed in a cultural experience and leave with a book, right? So there's a sense of taking a genre, in this case, a genre, a subgenre of genre fiction, and transforming it into something that would be an economic draw. And from what I understand from talking to the owner, they're doing okay. Right here, this is the woman unfolding this. Unfolding their own publications that they do, kind of folding in mystery ideas into little secret packets and things like that. So it's really, really novel and interesting. The next one I found really striking. This is a poet, I believe his name is Xu Le, and he's an avant-garde poet. His latest book that he had given me was in blank entirely. You know, it has his bio on it and a title, and you open it up and it's his blank. It's like, yeah, you should write, you could write your own in it. So you kind of get a sense of the bohemian style person that he is, and he's, you know, his own community is the avant-garde community, and yet he's the owner of a children's bookstore, and he organizes community events around parents, mostly mother and their children. And as we all walk into the store, I guess there are multiple slides here, you can't see it so well, but there's toys on one side, you'll see like kind of pedagogical for mothers and children, learning phonics, things like that. Some kitschy things. There's games that he invents that he plays with the parents in these social occasions. But if you can, I don't know if you can read the sign that he's holding. What it says is, buy books here. They're more expensive by, I think, 10 or 20%. So he's saying, you know, like, that's the catch. I want you to come in and buy books here. I'm actually making them more expensive than anywhere you will do on purpose because you are subsidizing community. And he makes the cost point of his, you know, what he's able to do and to get a margin of a profit part of the pivot to his customer. And I thought that was really interesting and because it kind of approaches the problem with both a iconoclastic avant-garde kind of feeling of, you know, to take it to the man in a certain sense. But also genuine entrepreneurial efforts on the ground, you know, kind of grassroots level with this community. And very much organizing around community also shows, I think, a lot about what the avant-garde world is like, but not necessarily thinking about one's readers. Usually one thinks about, or normally one thinks about readers and writers, but not necessarily customers. And so this is a really unusual space. Of course, there are places such as this one where you know, Taiwanese nationalism and the discussion of Taiyu and so on is very strong, right? And so you can go to a space like this, which has books and so on, organized around this particular angle of the Taiwan literary scene. This is a traditional bookstore, but again, we have a poet who's the owners. I met so many owners who are poets. I thought that was really interesting. He's a translator of the Rubaiyat. And intellectual, and yet he and his children run a store, you know, and again we find this this life in letters requires a degree of effort and grit when it comes to how to create a vocation out of the literary space that I find quite unusual from an American perspective. This was a really interesting place. There was literature here, but also a lot of handicraft arts, so handmade bowls, things like that, that is in the space where high-end patrons come and have meals cooked for them on location. And so this is me and the owner of this particular establishment, the chef, who invites people in, but sells, again, his community's artworks by merging it with foodie culture. And again, I thought that was a really interesting and novel approach to stimulating the sale of what is pretty hard to push, handmade crafts. I love this one. This is probably the greatest story of Taiwan literary culture. This is Ruxing Press, and Ruxing is a movable printing press. So, back from the Qing Dynasty period, this kind of technology was, of course, outmoded by digital technology about 15, 20 years ago, and today is completely obsolete. So what do you do with a storehouse of movable woodblock, or printing, it's not wood now, but the metal to print? And the answer was to start selling it, selling the actual type as a commodity. And so he and his son started to create small printing presses, and these boxes here are presses where you can go and select the characters that you want for your name or your business and so on, and you can actually press your own business cards using a printing press. And you know, they're not cheap, but they're so beautiful and so artisan and you know, really novel, and everyone I think loves letterpress, but to actually own your own type, I bought so much of this stuff, is really amazing. And they have turned around their business model entirely and are very successful now. And he tours all over the world giving lectures about the work he does. And his son is really the kind of entrepreneurial force behind it, always iterating his models and so on. All right, so the Taiwan literary art space, kind of connected to entrepreneurship, really showing a lot of vitality and ingenuity in the face of changing economies at scale. And that's something to discuss, what I wanted to share, although it's a bit off topic. Okay, so now to the archive culture, which is so strong in Taiwan. This is the Qidong Poetry Salon, and as you'll notice straight away that the architecture is Japanese. This is, of course, a high-level Japanese official who lived here in Taipei. And the city owns the building and then I think leased it to the Wenxue Boguan, which is in Tainan. We'll talk about it later. I'm not sure entirely. Maybe Gui knows more about this than I do, about who owns the space. But it is used as an archive space, a public space, to put on continual display various forms of archive documents of Taiwanese poetry. This is just a small snippet, but the entire space is filled with exhibited, curated spaces telling the story through primary materials of Taiwanese poetry from before state formation to the present. But this is a really interesting document for those of you who may have not seen the intergraphic representation of Taiyu, which doesn't in fact have a sinograph to represent the phonemes for some sounds. And so you'll find a mixture of sinographic and romanized. And it looks like code switching, but actually it is one language that's simply using two graphic systems of representation. And again, there's a lot here, and I had some notes about it. But that space is curated by the curators here at the Taiwan National Museum of Literature, which is in Tainan in the south. And you know, for an American to find a National Museum of Literature for is also something just to take note of, is quite striking. The collection here it's so much more like what we would expect to find in a library in terms of the curatorial. The idea of the customer is really interesting to me, because if you are a museum, typically you think of, you need to put together some really flashy things for the kids to be interested in, or how do you get foot traffic into it. You don't necessarily think that manuscript material, you know, is it. Now, there are beautiful displays that bring the manuscript material to life, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of just pure manuscript material. It's curated with the assumption that that those who are coming in are interested in, fact, seeing Taiwan literary culture in its primary form. And so, display after display of manuscripts, letters, draft material, and this one traces back to, I think he passed away, so this is an early collectivist short story about communism in Taiwan. Now, so that's the public space. So these are publicly funded archives. But the private collectors are also, I think, a phenomenon, including Wu Chang here, the poet. And he has his home is called the Book House. Because, and I have a video, but I was unable to embed it because it was, in fact, stored on a cloud. But his house is, which I can't show you, it's about four stories hall includes something like 50,000 volumes of books. But it's not just books, right? Also manuscripts. So as a private collector, his goal is to preserve Taiwanese literary culture, as well as ecological. So eco-criticism and kind of eco-cultural discourses. He's an activist around issues of ecology, but his archive includes some non-literary materials, but usually in the interface of literature. And so you have private citizens doing this work. And you have private foundations, such as, the Lai Ho Memorial Hall is the Lai Ho Foundation, is a private foundation that has, I think, writes grants and so on to the government, but is separate from the government and more provincial in its nature, and preserves the work environment of this poet. He is considered the one, you know, some consider, I will not say he is generally considered, but some consider him the father of modern Taiwanese poetry because of this style of writing. He wrote under like 8 pen names. He was a doctor, a medical doctor, and it really did establish some of the literary norms of his time. And the foundation is created to preserve his studio, so his office space, but also his manuscripts and his published material. It's very, very bibliophilic. Editions of all of his work are there. But there's constantly fundraising to create a park around the studio and to continue to bring people, especially students, in to do literary workshops and so on. Of course, there is a lot of, being in D.C., it's hard to ignore that there are, of course, political elements to all of the things that we're seeing. We could talk a little bit about that in the Q&A. Then we have collaborations between publishing houses, and this is really my model, between publishing houses and the archive. And so the Winston Magazine, which is one of the great literary magazines in Taiwan, publishes Taiwanese literature, but also curates and archives. And I didn't know that, but if you go in the back of the back end of their publishing area, you'll find the archive spaces. So here we have some of the archives of their own published materials, but beyond that, there are many tens of thousands of books that they've collected and manuscripts and so on, as well as a very robust, as you can see here, we have 5 data entry workers working on, you know, digitizing and creating repositories for the things that they're documenting. That kind of labor, of course, isn't cheap. And so some of the funding mechanisms of this is really inspiring. Again, I had a video of this, but I'm not going to switch over to it. You can find it on YouTube. But fundraising by asking poets and novelists and so on to donate some of their manuscript materials, and then have public auctions. And they auction those to private citizens, much like the poet who's collecting this work will collect it, fund that, and it helps them with their housing and their staffing and so on. So that notion of a close-knit, interconnected community around literary arts, but also not naive, but very much engaged and entrepreneurial, very economic-oriented, is really pretty wonderful. I mean, typically we work in the United States in grants from private foundations, or we have institutions supporting us, but the idea that we would be drawing upon the people that we're publishing and asking for them to submit some of their original material and then creating the kind of Christie's-like auctions for it, taking that revenue from that in order to bring it back into the system, right? You can see how and why that's so extraordinary. So on the digital side of this, we have private and public interest in that, creating the digital repositories of the stuff we just saw, as well as digitizing literature itself and bringing and collecting and managing this data. Unfortunately, this is moving so fast because, you know, this website has a lot of flash technology in it and so on, and you can see the problem with upkeep to try to maintain a viable digital space means a constant, constant rethinking through the medium, otherwise it becomes obsolete so quickly. So for me, the digital remains incredibly important, but primarily in the form of digitization and repository building for indexing and finding searchability of things, not this curatorial effort. So the curatorial effort is, it is important to do, but it's costly and ultimately very fragile. It's outmoded very quickly. All right, so now I'm going to switch a little bit to talk about my work in the archiving and publishing, and think a little bit about the relationship between the two. So, of course, this is in part, this lecture is in part about the launch of a book that I did in collaboration with the Taiwan Academy, who's here today and making, you know, one of the folks who are making this talk possible. Taiwan Academy has a new publication of books from Taiwan, and I recently read through all of them, thanks to Jack Wei bringing them to me. And it's really quite a wonderful publication. It's like first chapters of new books in translation, or not yet in translation, including children's literature. And you know, follows other spaces like South Korea, who's Korean Literature Now, formerly of List magazine, trying to, as it were, promote one's own literature abroad in translation. But this is not an easy venture because it requires high-end editing. Editing is very expensive. To translate is expensive, but to edit translations is also expensive. Because usually when you translate something, it's not yet in literary prose. And so to get it to literary prose requires a very highly trained specialist, usually a native speaker, you know, of that language. And so this is a great publication and shows some of the efforts being put into the intersection between translation and preservation of one's literature. So I'll come around and talk a little bit about this, but I'm going to keep moving for a second. So my own magazine and book series, Chinese Literature Today, that I started, and now we have, it's now under Zhu Ping Wang, is the new editor-in-chief, and if you'll raise your hand back here, or Professor Yu Min here, is the book editor reviewer long-term of this magazine. And the effort of the magazine is pretty simple. It's to try to understand, you know, as I wrote the original grant to establish this, try to understand how to bring more Chinese literature into English, not the language, but into English discourse. So how do you get more readers is one part of that, but also how do you get more chatter? How do you get more metadata from it? How do you get more interaction from it? Like, we want to, you know, find a way to change the 3%. Now, 3% is the word used, or the number used to describe how much literature is translated from other languages into English every year. But that's all languages, and that's also all genres. Okay, so when you get to the Chinese part of that, right, it's much smaller. Need to literature, it's much smaller. Need to poetry, it's much smaller than that. It's a very small number. Now, in mainland China alone, there's 200,000 plus books that publish per year. Taiwan is a very robust literary producer. So there's so much not being even, you know, brought into English. But those that are there suffer intolerable, slow, near non-existence insofar as it's difficult to get reviews, it's difficult to sell to readers, it's difficult to get scholars who are not Sinophone scholars themselves to review, let alone read, let alone teach this material. Now imagine if you are, and I'll talk about this a little later in the theory portion, but if you are an undergraduate at an American university, you will likely read something like Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, knowing nothing about Igbo culture or Nigerian history. But the fact it's written in English gives a teacher some feeling of agency, like they can teach this novel, but won't teach a novel in translation because it's translated and you don't have access to the original text. So what is it, you know, that translation seems to do about changing the nature of how we read, our reading patterns, and especially how institutional patterns are established? So I'm going to talk about that because that's my ultimate target that I'm trying to re-theorize. All right, so then there's also books, and so this is a list of our books, including some of the great novels from China. Mo Yan's masterpiece, Sandalwood Death, did sell pretty well. Fei Du, which has sold millions of copies in China, is the great sex book of the 1990s. It's the, you know, it's banned, and all the sex scenes are redacted. It's really very Victorian, and it's been so hard to sell. You'd think sex for Americans, but you still, it's translation. It's really hard to move that book. All right. So we move now from the idea of just publishing as the best way to get linguistic interaction between readers and Sinophone content, to the idea of archive itself. So what is an archive? So it includes, this is a, let's see, what am I looking at here? We have a Mo Yan letter and, you know, some signed books and things like that, but we also have letters from the editor. I'll go through some of these in more detail. letters to the editors, letter to contracts, how much people were paid, reviews that might have been written or not written, or not published but written. There's all sorts of kinds of ephemera that can circulate around a literary translation project for years, since they take so long to do. I wanted to show you this one example. This is a novella from Yang Jiang, who passed away a couple years ago. And this novella, this is its size, okay, just to give you a sense. It's not a very long book. These are the letters between the editor and Howard Goldblatt about translating that book. Now, in terms of the material study of that volume of Yang Jiang's work, or of the idea of translation itself, like what did they get right, what did they get wrong, etc., imagine being able to go in and find a detailed discourse that shows how and why they chose the particular word format that they chose. It is, you know, documented, and I wouldn't say it's excruciating. I would say that if I wasn't a translator, you know, because it's like, what is wrong with these people? Like, they're so concerned about which word goes where. But when you are a translator, the sub-